For more than 30 years now, entomologist May Barenbaum has used movies to spread her passion for the roaches, ants, mosquitoes, even the spiders among us. The Insect Fear Film Festival returns this weekend, and this year she set out to explore our complex relationship with pesticides. It's a theme that comes up often in her real-world research.
Compared to other insects, honeybees have very few genes for detoxifying poisons like pesticides.
The facts and fears about insects and pesticides. University of Illinois entomologist and the creator of the Insect Fear Film Festival, May Barenbaum, joins us. That's today's focus after this news. Good morning. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Jim Meadows today. When May Barenbaum first launched the Insect Fear Film Festival, she says Reagan was president, materialism was rampant, and insect movies were, well, terrible. A lot has changed over the past three decades, except, she says, the insect movies. Those are still terrible. Movies, even the bad ones, can be fun. They can also be tools to teach, and that's why every year May Barenbaum picks a theme for the film fest and creates a conversation with the audience about that theme. This year, it's pesticide fear films. And May Barenbaum joins us now in Studio C. She's a professor of entomology at the U of I and the department head. She's also, of course, the creator of the Insect Fear Film Festival, which runs this Saturday in Folinger Auditorium. May, welcome back to Focus.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's nice to see you. There's something inherently scary about insects, all those legs.
Can't argue with that. I used to be phobic, actually. When I was a kid, I was terrified of insects, and it was not till I took a college course that I realized, there are some you should be afraid of, but most of them no. And there's no passion greater than the recent convert, so even though that wasn't so recent, I'm still pretty passionate.
But here we think of you as somebody so comfortable around bugs, bringing this festival every year, and even you were afraid of bugs at one time.
In fact, a little knowledge is kind of dangerous, and there are some insects that people might think I'm unreasonably afraid. Most people consider mosquitoes just a mere annoyance. I see them as flying injection devices for all kinds of untreatable and debilitating diseases. So those are the ones you should be afraid of.
There's a dark side to knowledge, too, sometimes with these things. So this festival does have some of the scary stuff as well, but you've added a new twist. why pesticides?
It was sort of a convergence of things. I had recently become aware of a 1949 Gene Autry movie called Riders of the Whistling Pines, and was astonished on seeing this movie. I'd heard it had something to do with a tussock moth outbreak, so I'm sort of savantish in my relentless pursuit of insects in pop culture, so I felt that I really should see this film, and I was absolutely astonished to see that DDT, the world's most infamous pesticide, is actually the hero of the piece here. And to watch with 60 years of hindsight attitudes toward DDT in this film, I thought was revelatory. So first things, I became aware of this movie. And then the next thing that happened, this was in October, there was an open letter signed by 250 scientists, published October 30th, open letter to Congress, concerned about House Rule 1526, Raising Healthy Forests for Healthy Communities Act. This was legislation that authorized and, in fact, mandated in some circumstances salvage logging after forest fires in national forests. Hmm. The scientists had signed this letter because that policy violates decades of forest science, which abundantly clearly illustrates that you leave salvage wood in forests because many of these forest communities are so-called fire-adapted. They need the resources, released back to the forest via fire, and they don't get them if you haul the logs out. Well, the plot in this Whistling Pines 1949 movie, the evil lumber magnates want the trees to die from the tussock moth infestation so they can salvage the dead trees. More things change, the more they remain the same.
And you had said that you've heard about art imitating life. Here you have life imitating art.
Yeah, and I just thought this is too much of a coincidence to miss. And, you know, our festival is called the Insect Fear Film. So what fears would an insect have? Well, they'd be afraid of pesticides. Mm-hmm. So this, I guess, from the insect perspective, pesticide fear films make a lot of sense.
It really is a departure because, you know, the tussock moth, this is not a 40-foot-wide wingspan creature.
No.
We don't really even see it.
In the movie, there's, I think, 8 seconds I think it's about 8 seconds where you actually see a tussock moth. But there are, 60,000 acres, 30,000 acres? I mean, there's a...
It may be even more, is it? But yeah.
And, so the whole forest is at risk. In fact, it was probably a story ripped from the headlines because right around this time in Oregon, there was a Douglas fir tussock moth outbreak. So I think that whenever the screenwriter was like trolling for a plot line, he thought,
hey, this sounds good to
why
me.
Why not tussock moths? They were on everybody's mind. Today, not so much.
Yeah, and here we are all these years later. You know, it is a bit of a departure. You've got a singing cowboy movie with Gene Autry. As you mentioned, one of the heroes, at least, is the pesticide DDT. Before we talk too much about it, let's give people sort of a flavor of what this is. Our producer, Lindsay, pulled a clip from it. Let's go ahead and hit this. This is the Gene Autry movie, Riders of the Whistling Pines.
I think you're right, Autry. The only answer is to spray the entire area with a DDT solution. You think it can be done?
Yes, sir. I'm sure it can.
What do you think, Doctor? Any chance of the poison affecting wildlife or domestic stock up there?
No, I don't think so. If it's used in proper proportion.
Spraying more than 100,000 acres from the air is going to be a difficult operation. And a dangerous one.
If the moth larvae aren't killed before they mature, the forest will be gone. Isn't that right, Doctor?
That's quite correct. According to my calculations, we have another 30 days.
Then let's get to work.
Any chance of the poison affecting wildlife, domestic stock? No, I don't think so. We've learned a lot since then.
You know, it's funny watching this. It was surreal because I found myself rooting for the bad guys. I mean, the basic plot line is the bad guys want to discredit DDT and raise fears in the general populace so that the spray program will stop. So it's the bad guys saying, don't you think this might affect wildlife? Don't you think this might have? In fact, there was one great exchange. Let's see if I can find out where it is. It's, they're worried about the impact. Here it is. So, a worried local citizen wonders, what'll happen to the fish? One of the forest ranger colleagues assures him the timber's more important than the fish, and the local responds, not to the fish it ain't. And, he's right. He's absolutely right. And, in fact, DDT was known at the time to be quite toxic to fish. So, it's just amazing to sit there kind of rooting for the bad guys. And again, this is such a stereotypical Western. Literally, the good guys wear white hats and the bad guys wear black hats. So no trouble figuring out who's a bad guy here. Yeah.
And not only rooting for it, but you said that you were also struck by the accuracy of some of what at the time was considered the bad guys' disinformation.
Absolutely. All the concerns raised by the bad guy in retrospect, it's astonishing. I mean, at one point, Autry, who's a good guy, supposed to be a good guy, thinks it's not necessary to alert the locals of the spray program. Like, really?
Which now would be unheard of.
Unheard of. And just in general, I don't even see what the justification would be for not informing the populace of any kind of spray program. An amazing insight into a very different era. Mm-hmm. Along those lines, we have some clips of films just illustrating how different a world it was, one of which is from a 1956 documentary illustrating how the safety of DDT was tested on prisoners in Alabama who were fed a DDT, like 25 milligrams a day.
Ingesting this chemical into them.
You can see them. In film, you see them sort of downing little cups containing DDT solution.
Wow.
And in fact, when people in the 60s started to be concerned about non-target impacts, some of the more extreme advocates of synthetic organic insecticide safety would tour the country doing demonstrations where they would eat DDT in front of big crowds.
Just to prove that, look, this is safe. Yeah. We've done the research on this. So it's in talking here, you talk about the movies and also the issues that you bring up. I mean, obviously, it's fun to watch many of these movies. it can raise awareness of all sorts of variety of creatures going around us. But you clearly seem to have a bigger picture goal with the festival. What is that?
Well, I guess in general, it's my own sort of whatever, journey, life voyage. Knowledge is power. So if you know the reality, it's a lot easier not to be scared or not to be fooled or not to, you know, once you have good information, you can make better decisions about things. So and partly it's a little bit of insect appreciation, and partly it's just insect information, and and partly it's just fun. I mean, there would be no other reason I would sit through a Gene Autry movie. I mean, it's kind of trippy to watch these sort of spring into completely irrelevant songs for no apparent reason. I tried to transcribe a couple of these when I was watching it. There's one yodeling song in there. It was really hard to get the yodel down. Tuli, tuli, uli, oo. I think it's beneath the alpine moon. Yeah.
you've got insects. You've got murder. You've got, you know, plots to assassinate and everything else. I mean, yeah, and singing cowboys.
Yeah, singing cowboys. And it's just an interesting perspective on a different time.
Yeah.
And the other film is the other extreme. This is a screenwriter wasn't quite as well informed as the screenwriter for Whistling Pines.
And this is Locust.
Yeah, Locust, the Eighth Plague. It was a sci-fi film. And, you know, the television production.
Yeah, the cable network, yeah.
SYFY. And they graciously allowed us to use to show this film. And the basic concept is the military, for reasons that are never clearly explained in the film, decide that the best way to deal with pest insects is to genetically engineer locusts so that they become flesh-eating carnivores.
Makes perfect sense.
They can eat the insect. I don't know why. I mean, a reverse millions of years of evolution.
Because you need a theme for movies. That's
yeah. And locusts, are famous for biblical plagues and the like. But, of course, because it's one of these classic tropes, pesticides only make them stronger. You know, they're resistant to all pesticides. And it's true. Resistance is a huge problem with pesticides. But the hero entomologist, I don't think he wears a hat, but he's sort of an environmentalist type, and he has a special, quote, organic pesticide that he's trying to get the military to use. And somehow this is safe for the environment. And that was amusing, too, because the word organic has multiple meanings, and in
right.
none of the meanings would make this appropriate. back, you know, DDT is actually called an organic insecticide. It's a synthetic organic insecticide. Between around 1860 and 1939, most chemicals were inorganic. They were based on metals, lead, arsenate, copper compounds. So when chemicals could be synthesized, made out of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, and in the case of DDT, chlorine, those were called organic because in that era, carbon-containing compounds were organic compounds. So you say organic insecticide to toxicologists, that means DDT.
Organic can be just as poisonous as
Well, in that use, today's use, organic implies from nature.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the reasons people went to synthetic organic insecticides is that the botanical pesticides, what presumably this entomologist was referring to, Colt, I think his name is, these pesticides had undesirable non-target effects. Rotenone, for example, a completely natural plant-derived compound, deadly to fish. It's used as a fish poison.
Hmm.
So a lot of the nicotine from tobacco, neurotoxic to just about everything. So just because it comes from a plant or from nature doesn't mean it is specifically targeted against insects.
Yeah, and I know you've said about a number of the movies over the years that the special effects tend to get better in these movies, but the biology does not.
No, it's pretty much remains the same. You could lift some of the dialogue, actually, out of movies from 20 years ago, and it's still pretty much what you hear today. So.
All right, we'll talk a little bit more about the festival itself and then some of the issues that have come up with pesticides. You've done a lot of research into bees and things like that, too. Also want to invite listeners to take part in the conversation. If you want to talk with May Barenbaum about pesticides and bees or other insects, give us a call. The number is 1-800 800-222-9455. Again, 800-222-9455. You can also drop us an email. That address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Excuse me, will-talk@illinois.edu. Some of the other movies that are coming up here is there's a couple of shorts. Mickey's Garden is one. And this is, well, can you tell us a little about what happens in this one?
Well, this Mickey Mouse, this is pre-DDT, but Mickey Mouse is treating his garden for insect pests with one of these classic spray guns, flick guns, you know, with a pump.
And the little cloud comes out the end of it. And
right. And he's overcome and he ends up, I guess, spoiler alert, in a dream sequence where he imagines he's the size of an insect. So sort of an empathetic view of the world of insect pests and gardens.
And now, it was interesting, too, to see it because this one treated pesticides almost like taking a stiff drink as opposed to anything that might be poisonous. You know,
right, with short-term effects. So, but what was amazing subsequently, I have an odd hobby. I have many odd hobbies, all of which revolve one way or another around insects. But I collect insecticide memorabilia, so old pesticide containers, pesticide application
devices.
Yeah, and labels and the like. And the one thing I'll say about it, invariably, this it's dirt cheap and the people who are selling it are really, really glad to get rid of it. So. But as one reason I'm interested is you can see how things have changed. We always have an insect petting zoo. We'll also have a pesticide petting zoo, so you can actually.
What is a pesticide petting zoo?
Well, you can touch a can of DDT, for example.
Oh, okay. An empty can of DDT.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I actually do have DDT in a sealed glass container. The entomology graduate students, when I first arrived, synthesized it in their class as part of insect toxicology. Very simple synthesis. It's dirt cheap. That's why it was so abused. Yeah, I mean, the sort of American approach to things, if a little is good, more is better. This stuff is so cheap that people started massively abusing it, you know, using way too much when it wasn't needed. We ended up with extensive resistance and contamination so thorough. I mean, one of the selling points in the 40s for DDT and the other chlorinated hydrocarbons is they never break down. Well, that's great if you want to treat your termite for your basement for termites.
Right.
Not so great when it escapes into the environment and it's 60 years later and it's still circulating. There was a recent news story relating the Alzheimer's, incidence of Alzheimer's, to levels of DDE, which is a metabolite of DDT. So again, 1972, domestic use of DDT was banned. Yet, here we are 50 plus years later after the heyday of DDT, and people still have metabolites circulating in their body.
These long-term consequences are just kind of hanging out there in the environment.
And you don't see them when you stand up at a podium and slug a solution of DDT.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about some of these other, the broader issues that you're getting at, the research that we're starting to see now, I mean, what is the... what's the message you hope to convey, and what's the conversation that you hope to spark around some of these films?
I guess that for people to understand, pesticides themselves are not evil. It's how they're used. So they can be easily abused, and you really have to understand the whole environmental picture rather than just the pest itself. Back in 1959, in fact, an approach called integrated pest management, which antedates Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, was advocated by entomologists who argue that you should minimize as much as possible the use of pesticides and integrate the use of pesticides into other pest management techniques, which have far less serious environmental consequences.
What might those be, and what kind of...
Microbial control. So, in fact, it's interesting, the tussock moth outbreak, the real one, Douglas fir tussock moth, DDT spray got a lot of credit for fighting back that outbreak. But if you actually look at the dynamics, these tree-feeding lepidopteran caterpillars periodically go through cycles, predictable cycles, so where the populations build up and then they crash and then they build up. Gypsy moths do this and then they crash without any human intervention. And the reason they crash is when populations reach very high densities, other factors kick in, particularly disease and predators, pathogens and predators. And it appears that at the height of that Douglas fir tussock moth outbreak in Oregon, before massive spraying began, they were already starting to display the effects of epidemic disease. And they may have just crashed without the DDT. Hard to say. But there are natural enemies, they're called. So pests have a whole array of organisms out to get them. We can use those organisms. There are baits and pheromones you can use to bring the pest to the pesticide rather than broadcast spraying it. In the late 60s and early 70s, an approach called sterile male release was developed, where you irradiate males and release them. And in species that mate only once, the sterile males mate with the females, and that's the end of the population. So, again, no non-target impacts. Unless you happen to be a very disappointed female moth or something. Actually, sterile male release would be mostly some of the fruit flies, medfly, for example, screwworm flies. They were the initial targets of sterile male release. Hmm. All kinds of ways to manipulate insect populations that don't involve especially neurotoxic chemicals. People like neurotoxic chemicals because they kill quickly. They paralyze or kill quickly. I mean, to the readers, listeners out there, how many times have you sprayed something and watched it writhe with some sort of satisfaction? So often, though, what you don't see with some of these fast-acting pesticides like the pyrethroids, an hour later, they just sort of shake themselves and come up, you know, and crawl away or
go
fly
right away.
They have it's called knockdown. They have a very fast knockdown. And that's a good selling point for especially a homeowner.
Yeah, if that roach crawling across your basement floor or something.
Yeah, die, you evil thing.
Right, exactly. That or stomp and you know, hear the squish. There are industry relies on things like this. I mean, there's a pest problem, and there are some solutions for it. I mean, as an entomologist, somebody who looks and studies this day in and day out, I mean, what is the best case scenario, really, knowing that there is a problem that needs to be addressed? People rely on crops planting for livelihood in many cases. How do you balance that?
Well, one thing that's come up with bees and pesticides right now, pre-treated seeds are very popular. So these are seeds that are pre-treated with fungicide and a group of chemicals called neonicotinoid pesticides. And there's two reasons for the pre-treatment. The fungicide is there so that when the seed germinates, it doesn't succumb to some of the soil-dwelling fungi. Now, the reason for a systemic pesticide, rather for pre-treating with a neonics, is that then the pesticide is incorporated to all parts of the plant. So you don't spray. There's no sort of collateral damage to the environment. But the problem is when it goes systemic, it gets into the vascular system of the plant and ends up in nectar and pollen, where bees can encounter these pesticides. Now, the general problem I have with systemics is that, again, this idea of integrated pest management going back to 1959, you don't treat a problem that you don't have. For example, routinely prescribing antibiotics every time someone has a sore throat when you don't check and see if there's actually bacterial infection. Well, that widespread use of antibiotics has ended up selecting for resistance. So now some of the old standby antibiotics are useless. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the old standby pesticides. With systemic use, treating something that isn't there is a needless cost to the farmer and it's a needless cost to the environment. But it is all the rage now, at least in part because treating a problem that is there means careful monitoring. And many of our monoculture farms are thousands of acres, and it's very labor intensive to do scouting to see if and when a pest problem appears. And, you know, it's sort of a form of insurance. Because it's available, people can buy it. They don't have to walk the field, look for pests. But, I mean, one possible consequence is this collateral damage to pollinators.
Okay. We are talking with May Barenbaum, the creator of the Insect Fear Film Festival. That is this Saturday in Folger Auditorium on campus. It starts at 6 o'clock. A number of movies. We can talk more about the other ones coming up here. Also, of course, professor of entomology on campus, department head, University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign. If you'd like to talk with her, we're going to talk with her about pesticides, bees, the Insect Fear Film Festival, or other questions about insects, give us a call. The number is 800-222-9455. Again, 800-222-9455. Our email address, again, is will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to focus in on some of the your research into bees here in just a moment. But coming back to the role of DDT, and you mentioned earlier a number of studies that have been done that suggest a correlation between one of the chemicals from DDT, the residues there, and a higher risk of Alzheimer's. There was another one I saw more recently. I should mention these are, as studies go, relatively small sample sizes, and there's general agreement that more research needs to be done. But that also shows now a link between other pesticide chemicals and a risk of Parkinson's disease. Are you familiar with that research as well?
Well, it doesn't surprise me because, again, people love these neurotoxic pesticides. And there are differences in the nervous system of an insect, nervous system in an insect and a human, but there are probably more similarities than there are differences. Recently, a class of neurotoxic pesticides called formamidines was recently approved for use in the hive for beekeepers to treat mites, a parasitic mite called varroa, big problem for beekeepers. If I were a beekeeper, I wouldn't get it. I mean, I'm not. I'm a bee landlord. Mm-hmm. University of Illinois has an apiary on some land we own. But but it's neurotoxic, and there are studies that show formamidine insecticides have adverse impacts on the behavior of fruit flies, and they're not nearly as smart as honeybees. So, but again, they work quickly, and that's satisfying for someone who's watching his beloved bees get, you know, parasitized. So it's a real problem, but it's not at all surprising that ICIDE and the word pesticide, it means kill, and that's exactly what these chemicals are designed to do.
And one of the things that we seem to be learning more about also is not – there are certainly specific concerns about any one pesticide, fungicide that may be out there now. We're also starting to learn more about how they interact as a group once they get out as a whole in the environment and the effect on that. I mean, what are we learning in those terms?
Well, actually, we published a study a few years ago. The two pesticides that were approved for use in hive against the mites, one is called Cumafos and the other is called Tau-fluvalinate. One is a organophosphate, the other a pyrethroid. And it turns out, in the wake of colony collapse disorder, a chemist at Penn State found out that 100% of the wax samples he analyzed were contaminated with both of these miticides, these mite-killing pesticides.
Hmm.
And Reed Johnson, a graduate student in my lab, showed that the two interact with each other. One synergizes the other. So a non-lethal dose all alone in the presence of the other pesticide becomes a lethal dose. And subsequent work that we've done showed that honeybees actually have very few genes for that code for detoxification enzymes compared to other insects.
So they're more vulnerable too.
So potentially they just can't handle as many toxins. And yet these chemical analyses are showing upwards of 120 different pesticides, not just insecticides, but fungicides, herbicides, rodenticides, you name it, sides, are turning up in wax, in bee bread, in the bodies of the bees themselves.
Does that, I mean, are you, as somebody who's fairly immersed in this, personally concerned about pesticide or pesticide residue affecting humans?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it's, again, we humans are also subject to these interactions among toxins. In fact, you know, our whole strategy as a species in dealing with toxic substances is, you know, a little moderation in all things. So we're big, long-lived mammals that are highly mobile, so we can move around. We never eat too much of any one thing. You know, if you ate only onions, you would die. I mean, the onions have toxins in them. If you ate, you know, drank nothing but coffee. So our whole detoxification system is built around relatively low intake of a very broad diversity of natural substances. Mm. So what we don't know is what happens when, for example, producers of these diverse crops all converge on the same pesticide. So our systems have not evolved in the context of large quantities of a single class of chemicals. So that's kind of a big unknown.
And as we're learning, you mentioned some of the studies before. With each study that happens, we learn a little bit more about how those, and at least a lot of unanswered questions too.
Well,
at this point,
I don't know if anyone out there has, you know, looked at the labels on prescription drugs, but a lot of times they'll say don't eat with grapefruit.
Hmm.
sounds like an odd, you know, anti-grapefruit kind of prejudice
or something.
What's
wrong with grapefruit, right?
Well, it turns out grapefruits contain a group of natural products called franocoumarins, which I've been studying for many years. And these are in humans. I mean, they occur in plants in the citrus family, including grapefruits, and also some of the plants in the carrot family, including parsnips. These chemicals bind irreversibly to some of our detoxification enzymes. What does that mean? It means it inactivates them. So you get a dose of a drug. When your detoxification enzymes aren't working, it becomes an overdose because you can't process it the way most people are. So that's why there's warning labels against eating grapefruit.
That's interesting. We're talking with entomologist May Barenbaum about this weekend's 31st Insect Fear Film Festival. The theme this year, pesticide fear films. And up next, we'll get into some more of May's research, focuses on bees. We'll talk about the latest research into what's killing off so many of the hives and what we've learned in recent years. And, of course, your calls. If you want to talk with May Barenbaum about bees, pesticides, the Insect Fear Film Festival, other insect questions, the number is 800-222-9455, or drop us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Stay with us. It's Focus on WILL. And welcome back to Focus here on WILL. In the movies, it's often bugs playing the bad guys. At least in one case, pesticides save the day. Real life is, of course, much more complicated. We're talking today with May Barenbaum ahead of this weekend's Insect Fear Film Festival. She's the festival's creator and a professor of entomology here at the U of I, as well as the department head there. If you want to talk with May Barenbaum about bees, pesticides, any other questions about insects, she is here and ready to answer those. Give us a call, 800-222-9455. You can also reach us by email. That address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And we talked about some of the other films that are being showed at the film festival here this weekend, including that one where DDT is kind of the hero, if not riding and singing on a horse with a white hat, at least what the person riding on the white horse or the horse uses to save the day. For those who've never been, what can they expect at an Insect Fear Film Festival?
Well, the first hour, actually, before the film start, we have like to think of it as meet the stars. So whatever insects we're featuring, you can actually see real-life examples. So, praying mantises that are not the size of, the Chrysler Building in New York. And we have an extensive arthropod petting zoo with all kinds of, not just very charismatic insects. We have some lubber grasshoppers, some the world's second largest ant species. It's about, what is that,
an inch and a half
or something. Really, they're called Dinoponera, dino meaning enormous, like
dinosaur. Yeah.
And
these are alive.
Yeah, everything is alive. Some non-insect arthropods, like we have some tarantulas that are used to being handled, and millipedes, really, I think, charming giant millipedes.
I've never heard anybody use that word with millipedes before.
They're very cute, actually, entirely harmless. And tobacco hornworms, which are, 4 inches long or so. And the worst they'll do to you is possibly defecate on you when you're not expecting it. And you can survive that.
Right. A little soap and water.
And then we also, for the kids, there's face painting. There are all kinds of other hands-on activities. We have an art competition across all the schools local area. So at 7, the program begins. We'll give out the awards for the art competition. There is a raffle for the first time this year. We have some beautiful etched glass tumblers with the logo of the festival.
I was wondering what the bug theme would be there with the glasses, the tumblers. But they have the logo on them, and that's part of the art contest every year for a T-shirt and the logo and all these things.
So you can have your own 31st Annual Insect Fear Film Festival glass tumbler.
Yeah.
And then I usually introduce the films and with information not just about the movies, but about the science behind the movies, or in some cases not in the movies.
Right.
And it's basically 6 hours of free entertainment. And
That's important. It is free.
It's entirely free, open to anybody. And it looks like, people have asked us why on earth we do this in February. I'm not quite sure how this started, but it looks like we will not have a blizzard this year, which is good.
Although if you add up all the snow we've had so far, maybe combined, it's a blizzard. So the one movie we haven't mentioned yet so far is Pink Pest Control. That's another short and animated one, The Pink Panther. We had mentioned Mickey's Garden before. Similar themes come out of this one. We did get a phone call just a minute ago at 800-222-9455. Susie in Champaign, she couldn't hold. But she says, you know, I'm a gardener. She hadn't really put any thought into what she'd been spraying on her flowers until just this year. And she's wondering, are there resources for gardeners about how to control pests without spraying?
Yeah, your local extension office can help you with that. And in fact, that's one of the great values of having an extension entomologist. Phil Nixon is the extension entomologist at the University of Illinois. There are all kinds of ways. It all depends on your goals and your time budget and your financial budget, but many, many options other than pesticides. There's a recent move by the Xerxes Society for the Preservation of Endangered Invertebrates appealing to garden stores across the country to stop spraying the flowers that they sell, because often homeowners will buy these flowers not having any idea that they've been treated with systemic pesticides, put them out in their garden, they end up killing pollinators.
So. I think it was interesting, too, that she says, you know, that she just hadn't thought about it. I would imagine it's a very common experience. But does that tell you that there's just not a lot of information out there?
That's one reason we like to focus on pesticides. So it's sort of what gets a lot of press are pesticides that growers use because of the acreages. But really, when you think about it, farm acreage isn't that much greater than if you add up all the lawns, all the highway rights of ways, all the other places, parks, gardens, and other places where people don't really think about what pesticides are being used.
Right. Well, we talked earlier about your research on bees, and that's been an important part, especially recently. When we first heard about colony collapse disorder, it was 2005-ish, I think.
Fall 2006, and really hit the newspapers in February 2007.
Okay, all right. So, I mean, relatively recent at this point. We're still just beginning to understand what this is. I guess, why don't we start? Let's back up a little bit. Remind us, what is CCD?
Colony collapse disorder is a term that was used to describe a mysterious, for want of a better word, malady afflicting America's bees in late 2006, early 2007, whereby the oldest, most experienced bees in the hive, the foragers, the ones who actually go out into the environment, were just disappearing. They were not returning to the hive. There were no dead bodies. Very aberrant honeybee behavior. Normally, you can't, you know, pay a bee to leave its queen, the colony's queen, and the larvae and the food supplies, and these were just disappearing. Beekeepers, you know, fourth-generation beekeepers had never seen anything like this. And that sort of raised awareness that we really don't know much about honeybees, even though we depend on them utterly for pollination of 90 crops. It's a $20 billion enterprise. So U.S. agriculture depends on the pollination services provided by honeybees. So 7 years later, we still have bee decline, serious losses, overwintering losses, but it's not clear it's whatever that phenomenon was in 2007. We never really developed like a molecular diagnostic. Mm-hmm. Again, like you go to the doctor and you get a test and you know what particular virus you have. But in the interim, in 7 years, we found at least a half a dozen unreported viruses, a new parasitic disease, all kinds of information about residues and hives we didn't know. We have learned more in the last 7 years in this crisis situation than in the past 20 all put together.
And the you talk about sort of how important bees are in pollinating agriculture, things like that. All of this comes back right into the grocery store. I mean, this affects food prices. This affects other things as these chemicals get out there into nature. And theories on what's going on here, I mean, it's included everything from, you know, I've seen bees getting lost on the way back to the hive for various reasons, to the mites that you mentioned earlier and maybe carrying a virus, maybe other reasons, to genetically modified crops. Where are we right now in understanding what this is really about?
Well, the general consensus in the scientific community is that it's a combination of factors. I personally think nutrition is hugely important. just like with people, if you're well-nourished, you can handle all kinds of stresses. And bees are stressed out by the homogeneity of our environment. So we have huge, massive monoculture crops. We have losses of wildflowers due in part to genetically modified herbicide-resistant crops, due to mowing, due to biofuel feedstock crop planting. Drought is another problem. So it's a multiplicity of factors that all sort of feed upon one another. And there's nobody sees a simple solution, a simple, you know, magic bullet here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, still a lot more to learn. Let's go now to Olga on line one, talking not about bees, but I guess
I like all
relatively
bugs.
Close
okay.
relative with wasps. Hi, Olga. You're on Focus.
Hi. I hate pesticides. I don't use any chemicals in my yard at all. But I get a lot of wasps, and I've been bitten so many times or stung so many times that I have resorted to getting wasp spray from, like, Lowe's. And I'm wondering how dangerous it is. It just shoots up, and it's very focused on the nest, but I don't know what the residual effects are. So how dangerous is it to use those?
Hard to say without knowing exactly what's in them. But like you say, it's not like you're broadcasting across the entire lawn. And the nice thing, if there is a nice thing about wasps, is that at least they all hang out in the same place. So, you know, there is a clearly identifiable nest. Do you know whether they're hornets or yellow jackets or what kind of wasps, your paper wasps?
I don't know. They just build those little cones, you know, those little honeycomb kind of things underneath my deck or underneath the eaves in the house. They're not large. They're probably about as big as they are, probably about an inch.
And are they like orange and black, or are they yellow and black?
They're probably yellow and black.
Okay. Because usually
they seem brown to me.
Yeah. Like. Yeah, it's probably Pilices. And again, they don't have large colonies, and I can understand why. Well, compared to hornets will have hundreds of individuals. But
okay, well, there's like dozens. I mean, literally dozens. When I've sprayed it, there, I have found like 10 or 11, 12 dead. You know, that fall out of the nest.
And so, is it like a papery nest, like a
yes.
bulge? Oh, yeah. Well, that might well be hornets if they're yellow and black and is a papery kind of classic, you know. Well, what people will call a beehive, but beehives don't really look like that. But that sort of football-shaped thing, right?
Yeah, they're very aggressive. I mean, they come after me.
Yeah, those are probably either yellow jackets or hornets, and they are aggressive, particularly in the fall. Is that when you have a big problem with them?
Right when they're first starting to build their nest. Underneath the eaves or any gaps in the deck where they can just hide, are safe from the water, you know, from rain.
Yep. Yeah. Well, you know, one point about pesticides is that they're not inherently evil. So if you use them properly, and it sounds like if you're just targeting the nest, it's unlikely you're going to have any non-target, you know, adverse environmental impacts. And
well, what about anything that might eat the dead wasps or the dead hornets? Should I be careful about picking the bodies up? Birds, you know, because of the birds.
Well, hard to say how much each individual wasp actually ingests and whether that would pose a risk. But, that would be incredibly conscientious of you. Usually dead bodies don't last very long out in nature, and probably ants are the ones that would be picking it up. But, so I wouldn't feel bad about using. That's another message is sometimes there are appropriate uses for pesticides. I like to advocate sort of compatibility, but particularly if anyone has an allergy, there's no reason to take the risk of a sting. I had a sort of an argument with my husband. We had some adorable organ pipe mud dauber wasps that built their beautiful mud nests that look like organ pipes. That's why I call them organ pipe. Hmm. And they are not very aggressive, not like hornets. They have more simple societies, not these complex societies. And they actually sting and kill spiders, pretty harmless to humans. And Richard knocked all the nests down. Like, why did you do that? Like, they're not going to sting us. And basically because we have visitors, and if anybody's allergic, that's a problem. And even if people are not allergic, but they're afraid and they trip and hurt themselves. So there are perfectly good reasons for not cohabiting with insects.
And, yeah, especially ones that sting.
And hornets are, and yellow jackets too, get very unpleasant. Even I will concede that point, that they don't make good neighbors sometimes.
Well, Olga, thank you very much for the call. I wonder, too, talking about insects and thinking about, you know, certainly I've had wasps and hornets and things around my house, too. They vanish during the winter. I'm wondering, this has been a very cold winter. Is there any effect on the insect population here based on the temperatures?
A lot of people would love to know. We get that question every winter. If it's a nice winter, people ask entomologists, well, will that mean more bugs?
And
if it's a really cold winter, will that mean fewer bugs?
Yeah, mosquitoes, wasps, are they all, you know?
And the answer is yes. There are so many different species with so many different overwintering strategies that whatever the conditions are, some will do well, some will not do well. There's a general hope, for example, that emerald ash borers are an Asian invasive species that are wreaking havoc with ash trees all across the country. And there are some climate models done by some entomologists at University of Minnesota that suggest maybe this otherwise uncontrollable pest may suffer a setback in populations due to the extreme cold that it's been experiencing. It may be beyond its physiological limits.
Hmm.
We'll see.
Yeah. We got an email from Mark. He says that he's always had an intense revulsion to cockroaches.
Uh-huh.
I think he's in good
company.
Not alone
in that, yeah.
He says, would it be worse, would we be worse off if cockroaches were eliminated? He's wondering what valuable functions they perform.
I often get that question sometimes about mosquitoes, sometimes. But insects in general are often at the lower strata of food webs. And they're important food for a lot of organisms. I mean, at least a quarter of mammals rely on insects from some part of their life cycle, and most birds, even fruit and nut-feeding birds, will often feed their nestlings insects because they're high protein. And cockroaches are among the generally more palatable of insects that can feed the rest of a food web. So the most problematical cockroaches, we have lots of cockroaches, actually, in North America you never see. It's only about half a dozen species that live with us in our homes, and it's our fault. We brought them here. Most of them are native to Africa. The so-called German cockroach, African. The so-called American cockroach came from Africa, probably as a consequence of the slave trade. So condign retribution here. We live with cockroaches because we transported them out of their tropical African home and moved them into their tropical indoor environment.
Mm-hmm.
So cockroaches in general, there are many thousands, a couple of thousands species, and we don't even see most of them. So, and out in the woods, they're playing a valuable ecological role.
Yeah. We've only got a couple of minutes, so just trying to tie back a little bit. You know, the film festival this year, clearly trying to start a conversation about the human relationship with pesticides as well as obviously the insect relation to pesticides. We talked a bit about DDT earlier and some of the effect on that. That's been banned. No, you can't use that one. We're starting to see similar bans pop up in Europe with some of these. They look into the I'm going to mispronounce this, but the neonicotinoids.
Neonics.
Thank you. That's much easier. Do you see that as a trend? Do you expect that to happen in other places?
Well, I went to a meeting in England expressly to figure out what's going on in Europe because their agriculture is quite different from our agriculture. And it's complicated. And as you said, we have only a couple of minutes left. There will be, steady agitation to at least restrict certain usages, permissible usage of different pesticides. And, you know, with good reason. There are often pesticides are used in a manner that is unnecessary and environmentally risky. As to whether we will ever wean ourselves from pesticides, I would take that bet any day. We are going to be living with chemicals for some time, and that's just the nature of American agriculture.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to grow certain things and do it in certain, being competitive and make the livelihood off it and feed the kind of population we have, there is, as you mentioned, that kind of that balance.
And there hasn't been a lot of interest in an investment in alternative technologies, like use of pheromones, for example, tiny, tiny fraction of the whole pesticide market.
Okay. Well, the 31st Annual Insect Fear Film Festival is on Saturday, this Saturday, February 22nd, Follinger Auditorium here on campus from 6 until 9 o'clock. Admission?
No,
is
no,
in...
no. Way past nine.
Wait, okay. 10:30.
All right. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Six starts at six then. Admission is free. In addition to the films, as you mentioned, face painting, insect petting zoo, pesticide petting zoo. I've seen something here mentioned, a bug scope. What's a bug scope?
Bug scope is a U of I NCSA, National Center for Supercomputing Applications, amazing scanning environmental electron microscope where you can actually sort of remotely manipulate the microscope to get a really, really up close and personal with insects.
Neat,
you can
okay.
actually see them. And we partner with Bugscope. They come to the festival, and people can see what an enormously magnified insect actually looks
what
like.
What they look like. All right. And, of course, then the films themselves, the four films that we talked about. May Berenbaum, the creator of the Insect Fear Film Festival, she joined us here in Studio C. May, it was nice to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, always a pleasure.
And break a leg this weekend.
we got six, right?
You've got plenty of them there. All right. Well, Focus was produced today by Lindsay Moon. Mike Pritchard is our technical director today. Thank you for all of your help out there today behind the glass. Ryan Weber is our intern. Coming up tomorrow on Focus, according to historian and author John Locke, the history of the American Midwest has been far overlooked in its importance compared with the South, the Far West, and the East Coast. We'll listen back to a conversation Locke had with host Jim Meadows earlier this year about his book, The Lost Region. Reviving Midwestern History, that is coming up tomorrow on Focus. I'm Scott Cameron. I've been sitting in today for Jim Meadows, and this is Focus on WILL.